Hello again, I'm Michael Leeds, and you're listening to another special edition of the We Own This Town podcast. Here again, we continue the discussion with Apollo Up regarding their album Chariots of Fire, recently remastered and reissued on vinyl for the first time. If you missed part one, go back and listen to them speak about the inception of the record and all of the songs on side A. Here in part two, they cover everything on side B and everything that happened after the album was released. Thanks again to Ryan Irvin for interviewing the band, Jeremy Ferguson for lending his studio battle tapes to record it, and to the band for indulging me and sharing their stories. Enjoy.
Even if you don't die.
Okay. That one's one that went through a few different permutations.
Yeah. So, like, is there a story behind the tuning? Because, like, the next three songs are all in the same tuning.
Right. So, that is a tuning I came up with because I kept writing really similar sounding stuff, and I wanted to break out of that. And instead of making my fingers into different shapes, I just tuned the strings differently and played the same shapes.
Yeah. Which you did on Light the End, Burn It Through for some kind of Washington. Was it a different tuning? And that was like a thing.
Yeah.
It was like a J.
I would do that sometimes.
So like an exercise to write.
Man, we were really motivated and experimental.
Break out of writing the same kind of guitar parts all the time. And I guess I just was messing around, probably again on the sitting on that same couch here at Battle Tapes with that same acoustic guitar, just messing around with different tunings, and came up with one that I liked.
Was that when we were practicing in that storage space with Character and Loan Official?
Down there on 4th and Lafayette or whatever?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I think that's where that song
is. I remember all those songs.
But yeah, that's right. I forgot we actually practiced there.
But so we had an alternate version of the chorus.
I know that I came in with those chords, those opening three chords, and then that's all I remember.
Yeah, and that was one of the ones where, like, I had a job at the time that I, in retrospect, it was great because they paid me okay money to just hang out and not do a lot of work, and I had a lot of time to write lyrics.
What job was that?
At the CVB. I wrote a lot of lyrics at that job. Some on the toilet, some not on the toilet. But, like, that one I remember particularly, like, it's kind of informed by, like, workplace thing. Like, it was I don't know if this was like early social media time. I don't know how it came up, but like the idea was like gossip, people knowing secrets about you and like trying to cover it up and like people hounding it down. But like the whole like the investigators basically tracking down like who set this fire. Well, it's a guy trying to cover up a secret, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And those are some of my favorite lyrics that Mike ever wrote.
Oh, thanks. They're some of my favorite lyrics. I like them.
So I liked them so much that I didn't mind singing them.
I didn't change them.
But then the chorus, Jay had seen an ad for an insurance company that said, even if you don't die, we have plans for you.
Yeah. And I thought that was just irresistible.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the original. Those weren't the original lyrics, right? It was like automatic request.
We are here to serve.
A summons bearing your name that you can't hide. And then even if you don't die, we've got plans for you.
Yeah,
yeah. Don't be fooled by the dust on the bureau.
That was yours, right?
No.
Was all very different.
Was that mine? Yeah. Okay, weird.
That's why we changed it, because you couldn't stand that.
That song went through
dust on the bureau.
Many permutations. Like, it had very different parts for a long time.
Yeah, it changed around a lot.
Like, we worked that one. That was maybe a shift where things started to be more of a kind of a task, you know, like... Mm-hmm. Hammer things down. And
yeah, we definitely had to kind of just sit down and put that together.
That is the one that we recorded.
Mm.
Recorded that drum part for that little breakdown section to the end. And then Jay and I discussed it a whole lot. And we recorded it.
Oh, because there was a specific thing that I was trying to get across.
You were trying to get across.
It came from a square push or something.
I was like, is it like this? And he was like, no, I don't think so.
It was supposed to be like... Just like, there's a square pusher song called, what's that one called? I can't remember what that one's called. Boneville Occident.
Okay.
Which Mike had introduced me to. But this awesome square pusher is an electronic artist who makes crazy breakbeat.
Not sure you ever told me that that's what you're going for, but
I thought
regardless.
And at the end, there's a bit in the song where there's these really staccato accents in this certain pattern. And I was trying to get that idea across, but in a more rock and roll context. Anyway, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. So we recorded it, and then we, kept playing shows live. And especially, that was one of the first one, the the summer sessions or whatever that we recorded, and then we played a whole bunch, at least some shows before we recorded the other tracks at Alex Great. And we ended up playing it a different way, a way that I was personally more comfortable with. And that's when I was like, oh, shit, man. Yeah. I wish we could. Like, we tried to re-record it at Alex the Great just with didn't click happen. And overdone, but it didn't. Nothing lined up. It was all wrong. My only regret.
For the whole life.
In my entire life. In my smooth, easy, uncomplicated, very...
I've done it mostly right.
Do you skip over that one?
No, I still listen to it. But I just listen to it just to be like... Anymore, but. Jeremy Ferguson could walk in this room right now and say, hey, we're going to fix that.
I
would do it right this very second. Right, I would set those drums up.
Burn the 300 copies of the record that are in the mail.
Done. Nope. Yeah. I've Michael leads it
gotta
out.
Gotta do it over.
Look, now it's okay. Now it's ready to go.
Didn't think you were gonna get away with getting involved with Apollo business wise and not waste money, right?
We can waste.
We're the sweet spot between like high maintenance and low return.
Yeah.
This week's fun.
A record label's dream.
We're like right where they both meet in the middle. Yeah. And it's beautiful.
Like a total thing. Like
the Venn diagram.
Total waste of time. Like a total
hard to work with, total waste of time.
Hard to work with, will never make your money back.
We can't market.
Won't return your emails.
We can't sell their record. They keep changing this one song. I don't know.
Yeah.
No, that's I love that song. I love the I don't think I wrote the words, but like Jay added the tapping the phone lines, and then I just added the harmony on that.
Oh, yeah.
That's nice.
Like just towards the end.
And that was I don't like because it shifts into a major key there. And I don't remember if that was like a where that came from. Mm. I remember thinking that like sounded kind of like Badfinger or something at the time.
It was a conscious thing. I mean, we didn't
accidentally start playing that part.
No, I'm just saying like it. There was like there was a purpose in my like. Right. What if we?
So like this whole suite of songs, like the next, like these three songs were all sort of a Kafka-esque suite of like George W. Bush era.
Songs. Paranoia about
because we couldn't imagine politics. A politician worse than George W. Bush. The president of the United States.
The good old days.
Yeah.
Oh God.
So we
come back, Georgie.
Yeah, come back, George. Yeah, come back,
Georgie. We had these songs of the NSA, like even in the chorus of the next song, like live, Joe would be like, "Hey, here comes the NSA!"
Hey,
like it's like, all right,
Yeah.
But
yeah, we thought it seemed like it was a thing that was on everybody's minds: the Patriot Act, having your phone tapped, all that kind of stuff. And I bet like real activists from the '60s were like, "You guys don't."
They were listening to our records first of all.
Right.
That part of that song is my favorite to sort of play and just kind of people seem to sing along with it a little bit, and it's very.
The tapping the phone was.
Yeah. It's yeah.
It's very like big and
It goes big. It goes hard. It goes hard in the paint.
I like to listen to them.
It comes hard and goes in the paint.
It goes hard AF. Custom critical.
Yeah. Yeah. First question. FedEx.
PQR.
Yeah. It came from. I had seen it on the side of a FedEx truck. I think now I'm going to mention a band that I was in that they were not in when I was touring with Lotus Halo when we toured for like
boring
Lotus Halo, which was an instrumental band that I was in the late '90s in Murfreesboro.
One of my favorite local bands of all time.
Thank you.
One of the bands I was most jealous of all time.
It was we were pretty good.
A band I was in for one practice, and then I was like, guys.
A band I repeatedly, obnoxiously tried to somehow weasel my way into.
Yeah, it was a boyfriend and girlfriend band, Jeremy.
It was. One girlfriend, two boyfriends.
No. Sort of. Anyway. Point is, yeah. I saw that on the side of a FedEx truck, and I thought those words sounded really cool together. And it inspired a word tale of... I just think that's a funny phrase. Word tale.
a story. Let's go.
Yeah. It's a word tale. Anyways, yeah, it kind of fit in with the whole vibe of the Bush era
Harry Potter
paranoia stuff. And so concocted this story about someone showing up at your house and putting you inside a FedEx box. And those are the ones that are marked custom critical because they have someone inside them that has been kidnapped and taken to some sort of processing facility to be reprimanded for something they did.
I just used to count it off as HP?
HPQRS.
HPQRS.
Those four opening chords, yeah.
We would sing HBQRS.
Right.
And I don't know where that came from.
I don't know.
It was me. It was my fault.
Well, right. Well, those are the notes we're playing. HP.
Yeah. Yeah, right. The German, the H meaning B flat.
Right.
So we had we had the breakdown part that I wrote the lyrics for that was different.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I think at the time, based on the lyrics, the person who would actually dispatch the box to go get the person, and they were waiting across the street to watch.
Like with binoculars in a white van.
I looked up your address. I waited outside your house to see the look on your face. I'd trade it for nothing. Like this sort of like revenge, like I dispatched the custom critical team to pack you up and take you away.
Mm.
I watched it with binoculars and like, but yeah, then on the record, Jay played the
serial killer
played the bongos.
Congas.
Congas, sorry.
And the little break, the little percussion breakdown of the clapping part. That was another little thing, the clapping rhythm. I don't remember where it came from specifically, but we all just thought it was a great idea. And then I learned, like, last weekend that people find that rhythm hard to clap along with. Someone told me that. Yeah.
That's wrong. You guys are doing it wrong.
Nuh-uh. Nuh-uh.
I don't know.
Whoa. Oh, Mike's pulling a fast one on us.
Wait, what? What happened?
Isn't that right? That's right, though.
Wait, okay, wait, let's get this straight.
They just right. played
one,
together.
Two, one, two, ready, and.
Oh, you're doing a staggered part?
I'm doing what's on the record.
That's not what's on the record. Mm. That's not what I did. Wow.
Well, we just said the same thing, right?
Everybody's learning something.
Finding out new stuff.
Oh, I think I'm with him.
Okay, well, it sounds cool. Wow, I never knew that you were doing something different than us. Okay.
There's a couple of like single claps on the record.
No wonder it's so hard to do.
That's why no one can tell what the rhythm is. Well, it sounds
cool.
Probably
figured it out,
guys. Like staggered beats.
You're
okay.
Right.
Guys, you were right all along. That's hilarious. Wow.
It's impossible to clap along.
Wait, what?
Don't change what you're doing.
I don't think I could.
Sounds cool.
I don't think I could if I wanted to.
But yeah, so there's the clapping breakdown during which I played congas. Because a friend, Todd Kemp, who was the actual percussionist, refused to play the congas.
He's a mallet percussionist, not a hand percussionist.
That's right.
In 2005, I can totally see him
taking a stand.
Against
the tyranny of hands.
Or just like, maybe it was too jazz for him or something, too Steely Dan, I don't know.
He probably just opposed the congas being on a rock
record. On a rock record, yeah. I can see that for sure. He never explained why, but that's kind of what I assume. Anything else interesting about that song?
It goes right into
The Job's a Game.
The Job's a Game, which is another stolen title.
It's a title that's lifted from lyrics.
Well, yeah. So that song is basically lifted from the lyrics from the beginning, the spoken intro to Spoonful of Sugar from Mary Poppins.
In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun.
She just speaks it though, right?
No, that part is sung.
Okay, well anyways, yeah.
And then Sap, The Job's a Game.
Sap, The Job's a Game. So yeah, The Job's a Game. It's about cleaning up your room with magic. No, for real though, yeah, it's about hating your job, more or less, and how jobs are stupid.
The cool thing about that song is that it has, like, the big guitar solo before the vocal solo.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's nothing after.
Yeah, I mean, it was always a coda to Custom Critical. And was there a
like,
time when that was part of Custom Critical? Like before?
No, I think that was just a sort of jam tag.
Jam tag.
Coda.
A jam tag.
A coda, yeah. If you will.
Yeah, but I think we always played it at the end of Custom Critical.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
It was never like a standalone song that I know of.
Except on those demos, the Labor Day demos that we did where we were like tracked it separately.
Yeah.
And like Jeremy just led into it with a drum roll and that was...
Oh yeah, that was weird. Another fun thing about that song is that it has a very low in the mix, there is a Public Enemy sample from Terminator X to the Edge of Panic.
Yeah.
It has the song, the sound, there's a sound that loops in that Public Enemy song that has been in my head since I was 13 years old, and for some reason I thought it would be a good idea to put it in the mix on that. I don't remember why exactly, but it's like that sound.
Faster than that, though.
But yeah, like, we sped it up to be in the right key for the song on the record. So if you put headphones on, you can hear Terminator X to the Edge of Panic.
Also, don't tell Public Enemy that it's not
yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, that's why at the time I was like, well, they would be cool with this. Oh, yeah. So I was hoping that we might get sued twice, once by Disney and once by Public Enemy, and maybe get some publicity.
Well, maybe it will happen now.
Yeah.
Now that you
fingers crossed. Now that we have talked about it.
Yeah.
Now that we're all 40 and we can, you know,
I could go up against Disney's lawyers any day of the week.
And that's another one where we're like, let's call this its own track when we only had the 8 songs or whatever for the for the EP. They're like, we can call this a track, right? Let's just make it a thing.
But like live, we'll play those 3 songs in sequence.
I don't know if we've ever. Sometimes we drop off the Jobs of Game from the end of those.
Yes.
But I don't remember the last time we played.
Even If You Don't Die In.
Without.
I think the only time we've ever done it is when we've maybe played one of those 2 plus Heartbreak of Victory, because it's in the same tuning.
Same tuning, right.
And just done 2 of those. But I'm not even sure that that's happened.
Yeah. But yeah, so all 3 of those were kind of from that. You know, they're in the same tuning. I think we worked up all 3 of those at that practice space on 4th at Public Storage.
Yeah.
What tuning is that?
It is.
C-sharp.
C-sharp.
I know that.
F sharp, C sharp, E, A, C sharp.
C sharp being the low E?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I would just tune mine down to C sharp and then leave the rest of my guitar in standard tuning. So it was like a lot of like kind of acrobatic leaps up to get, you know, to find.
And also, you know, you can hear in both of those songs places where I play, you know, because it makes a pretty cool open chord. So I would sometimes just hit it as an open chord, like harmonics of that open chord.
Speaking of low tuning.
Mm-hmm.
Tennessee for Victory.
Well, yeah, so one thing about those low tunings is that kind of what made them at least not a giant pain in the ass is that the guitars that I always played in Apollo Up, continue to play, were built from parts from a company called Warmoth. So they're Fender replacement parts, basically, but you can buy all the parts and build your own guitar out of them. And they offer
a thin line.
That's the thin line telly, and the other natural telly that I have are both made of parts from Warmoth. And the necks that they offer all these customizations on the neck. And one thing you can get is a double truss rod neck, and the truss rod itself is actually made of like a composite graphite material, like a tennis racket. So they are much less sensitive to changes in tension and temperature and stuff like a regular guitar neck is. So those guitars could hold those crazy tunings with no problem. So that allowed me a lot more freedom in detuning my guitar. Yeah, so thanks, Warmoth. Give me some free stuff.
Yeah.
10 years later. But yeah, because of that, I felt confident about tuning from there, tuning that C-sharp all the way down to
an A.
And I guess we wrote Tennessee first of those 2, right?
No, I don't think we did. Because I remember plans specifically, there's a recording that exists somewhere where we literally kind of, that's the last song that we wrote totally just as a jam, as a band.
Yeah, that was because I mean, I had that riff up, like as a goof. Like, what if I had this crazy leap from this what is now an A string all the way up to the C sharp string way up high with this crazy, like, what, like 4 octave leap?
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know, it's possible we wrote Tennessee verse, but like.
But yeah, that riff was like a goof at first. I was like, doo-doo-doo-wee! Isn't that funny?
But I think that it got detuned. Like, I don't know. And again, this is just me remembering the recording. But like, there's like a 9-minute rehearsal recording of us playing this song where we're just like jamming out
on the Tennessee
verse. No, on plans. Where we like worked out the verse and the chorus. We kind of just like kind of hashed it out. And
so they had the same tuning.
Yes.
Yep.
And then like got to the like.
Oh, you're right. Because
like,
yeah,
Black Sabbath, His Hero Is Gone. Like kind of like big like drop. Riff and like just
at
we played it for
plans.
A long time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what
at the end of plans? Yeah.
Yeah, and then I guess the Tennessee riff must have come from that because I probably dropped the A I dropped that C sharp all the way down to A so that I could play that riff on an open string, and then from that tune the riff for Tennessee came out of that. I bet
it's possible. Yeah. I don't know.
But yeah, And it was just, you know, I thought we could use one more straight ahead rocker. We had that goofy riff, and it just kind of fell together quickly. It's pretty simple. It has a riff and like three chords.
And then some crazy high stuff.
And there's some little wheedle-a-wheedlas in there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fun to play.
And that's another one that's about, I don't know, the lyrics are like about being disillusioned with politics and stuff, I guess.
We played that one really fast live before.
Yeah.
Really fucking fast.
Mm-hmm. Usually, yeah. I don't enjoy playing that song. It's not fun for me to play. Because the way, the tuning that Jay's in, like, I'm not in a drop A on my bass. Like, I'm...
Right.
So I'm like...
So you don't get all the satisfaction.
I've got a lot of, like upper middle neck, like, reaches going on to, like, get... So it's kind of a chore. I don't enjoy it.
Jack Reacher.
It's a good song. Jack Reacher, yeah. Starring Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it was an A.
It's an A.
Oh, it's an A.
And that's something that, you know, I've totally... knew that was a thing that you could do from bands like Middle Tennessee hardcore bands like His Hero's Gone and From Ashes Rise and stuff. Like, I knew that they
more like West Tennessee than, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, like, I knew that they did that kind of stuff, and I was like, well, why can't I do that? And I definitely wanted to do a and riff like that.
He came in and he would make that voice.
What can I do?
We're like,
come
you
in
can, and Jay.
He'd walk in and he'd be like, hey, Jay, it's good to see you. And he'd be like, shut up.
Hey.
Listen to this His Hero's Gone song. And we listen to it, and he's like, why can't we do that?
Uh-huh.
And then he tuned down his guitar to A, and then we'd have to write a song.
We can. Okay.
But no, Habakkuk is also in that tuning.
Yeah, that was another one that came out of the A
another,
tuning.
Another song I hate to play.
I don't like to play that one.
I fucking hate this song.
Which one's that one?
That one did not work very well live. That's on Walking Papers.
With the saxophones.
Is that the one I played saxophones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a different record.
Do you guys have anything to say about plans?
The lyrics are about it's a post-apocalyptic love story.
So it is a girl that you're with in the bar.
Yeah, so the situation is, you know, it's like
I assume that too.
The end of the world type situation, which is another thing that I wrote about all the time, I guess. It's your average, you know, what you think of when you think of like a post-apocalyptic scenario. There's, you know, bombed out cities and what have you. And yeah, describing that scene, and then the guy, the main character, the narrator, is with a girl, and they go into, they duck into an empty bar, and then they probably have sex.
Well, I mean, let's leave it up to the listeners.
Right. Come on,
man. Yeah.
Let's leave some mystery.
They,
I was imagining them having
a bunch of cake ingredients.
Finding some recent newspapers and copy editing them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then they do a podcast.
Do a podcast with the abandoned equipment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
We found equipment for podcasts, and now...
We just keep going.
Yep.
Please keep doing it. Luke, please keep doing it.
That was Mike.
Mike Shepard.
All right, so we've gone through all the songs, came out. What happened?
Like,
that's the question.
No, that's the same question.
What happened?
I didn't mean it like that. I just mean like, what happened?
We broke up.
What happened?
No. So we
played some out of town shows behind it. We never really toured per se.
I mean, we did what we could. We all had day jobs.
Yeah.
We all had like. You know, some of us had mortgages, some of, you know, like it was a situation where it was like, Jeremy had a mortgage and we were in a situation where we were just like, well, what can we do? And so we burned as much vacation time as we could playing long weekends out of town, did like tried to set up like a regional schedule of, you know, shows, played like Atlanta and Cincinnati and Dayton. And
never made it west of the Mississippi.
Got to St. Louis. Is St. Louis west of the Mississippi?
St. Louis, Chicago,
Indianapolis. Yeah.
Okay.
Just west of the Mississippi.
Yes. The upper Midwest.
Yeah. Did you guys get in Minneapolis?
Indianapolis.
No. Indianapolis.
It's a little city called Mindy, Kentucky.
You know, man, it was like a convergence of things, probably. I think we are probably at a point where like, okay, let's just drop everything.
Do what we
go
can.
Do this.
Well, and
but
speaking
I was
for myself, I was in that mode for sure, and I had already like quit my day job to be like to go freelance as a graphic designer so that I could play more shows, and
yeah,
ended up playing more shows with Kickassettes.
Yeah, like, you know, the timing was unfortunate in that Jay had this and for Kickassettes kind of competing /dropping at the same time. I had a career at the time, which I'm still doing. So it was a little bit tougher for me to be like, fucking, here we go. And then Mike was kind of in the middle.
I was in the middle. Like, I had a little more time off, and I, like, you know, I was in a position where I could have taken leave of absence from work or whatever, but, like, couldn't have afforded to do that. Like, yeah. It was very contingent on, like, you know.
I've been accustomed to a lifestyle of,
yeah,
of $38,000 a year.
Yeah.
And also, keep in mind, too, that we were already, like, 29, almost 30 when this happened. So, like.
Oh, we were fully 30 when this happened.
Like, I was 29.
Wait, what year did this come out?
Well, no, when the record came out, we were 30.
What year did this come out?
When the record came out,
we were 20.
2006.
That's why I
think 10th anniversary. Speaking here now, I mean. That's
so we
a very
were,
young age.
We were not
28, 27.
But at the time, 28 it was like,
when we recorded at 27? 28? 28?
But it wasn't like a thing where we were all like 22 years old, let's go jump in a van and quit our jobs and go ride around the country playing rock shows, because we all were a little too, I don't know.
I had a car payment, Jeremy had a mortgage.
All those things.
Responsibilities. So, like, I mean, we did what we could. We played shows out of town, we played shows, we did weekends, we were real close to having an East Coast tour that just, like, fell apart, and we just canceled.
Yeah. So the touring thing never really came together for Apollo Up, ever, for various reasons. So that probably hurt.
We did a weekend with a band called the Carter Administration.
That went great.
I remember going well.
It was, man, it was.
That was
just for the folks out there. If you've ever been in a band that played a show where, or even heard of a show like this, because I know you didn't go to a show like this, because no one went to a show like this. It was a show in Alabama where Apollo Up and the Carter Administration were booked. The only people there were both of us band members, the door guy, and the bartender. That was literally it.
Right, to
Let
be fair.
Me. No.
To be fair.
No.
The bartender had a couple, no. like two friends.
They were outside the whole time.
Yeah. They were outside the whole time.
Literally no paying customers.
Jeremy did record the show, and then we went back and watched it.
Yeah, I've got it.
I've still got it. I've got it in my house.
So I was the cinematographer, the historian for Apollo Up, and anything else. I had this little super high camcorder whatever that I recorded all of our shit on for whatever reason. We had we had played at this place in Auburn called Roosters, and it was so badass.
It was always
awesome.
It was great. Every
with
time
Hermione,
we went there like three or four times.
It was packed. It was awesome. They took care of you. And then Roosters moved
to another part of town.
And
was
like
there was an Auburn
on
game.
On campus. Yeah, I think there was an Auburn game and something else was going on. And we played this show, and there was just nobody.
Literally zero paying customers.
Yeah.
Carter Administration and us.
I remember that the big thing about Roosters was their chicken. And then we got there, and the kitchen was closed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was
so
like,
when we went and played at Roosters.
We went across the street and ate hot dogs?
When we went and played at Roosters, the first time, they bought us shit. They had they had beer and all this
stuff.
They
treated
like
they wanted you to be there.
Hey, man, we got pizzas for y'all. Like, get in on this. This is big. You know, like.
And then we debated about taking our shit in there, I think.
Yeah, I think we did talk
about
it.
Yeah,
I probably leaned into it. I'll take the blame for that. Because Todd didn't want to play.
Yeah.
Getting back real quick. So the what happened was we put the record out. Like 2 weeks after the record came out, we played this festival in Cincinnati. The Desdemona Festival. Yeah. We met Ghostface Killah.
Yeah, we did.
Hung out with Ghostface Killah and his crew. We hung out with Enan and like we fucking played this show and it was a lot of fun. We had a really good time, and we sold, I think, and I mean, again, like, I've been in bands before and after this. I've never sold 25 copies of a record at a show.
Yeah, people literally lined up at the stage afterwards
like,
by the record.
Literally a line of people to buy CDs.
We got some good press from it. We were legit developing, like, a buzz in Cincinnati at that point.
And we just, like, it was just a situation where, like, we would have had to just keep playing, like, weekends out. Consistently, and we just didn't do it, you know.
Well, and I kind of, you know, in all honesty, you know, I saw Beth and Freak Sets were a little more open and doing more, you know, just doing more touring, more shows out.
Sure.
And that's what I wanted to do at that time.
Yep.
And I jumped into that van, literally. And you guys know that. That's not news.
Yeah. So, yeah, we did that. Jay was out for a while and then came back, and we drank a fifth of Bullet. One night, and then...
One night?
This night.
Well, no, twice as much as that. And we made the arrangements to break up the band. Like,
Was I even there?
You were. You showed up late. You showed up after we had... You showed up after we drank all the whiskey, and we were like, we're gonna go ahead and record the songs we've got. We're gonna do one more record, and
our swan song,
which is Walking Papers.
Yeah.
So like,
which to my ears is just a continuation of Chariots of Fire. Like,
it was like in the same mode, and I think some of those riffs existed in that era, in the Chariots of Fire era. It was only 2 years later, so
it could have been a part of the same record.
Yeah,
listening.
I think that makes sense. So then we banged that out.
And then right when the record came out, Jay was moving to Afghanistan,
which is the thing that I did.
That's right.
Because I hated Nashville so much around that time. Oh, and I was also started playing with Trail of Dead at that point.
Yeah, as a bass player.
Touring with Trail of Dead.
As a bass player, the call you want to get is your buddy who plays guitar saying like, hey, could I buy your Trail of Dead CDs?
I need to learn all their
Trail
songs.
Trail of Dead has asked me to go on tour with them playing bass. I know you're a big fan, so I gotta buy your CDs.
I was a fan too.
Buy your CDs.
And I was like,
and your bass and your bass rig.
Yeah.
And your heart. Can I have your heart? Because I just took
it. Sounds like a lot of fun. That sounds like a great time.
It was fun, and then it wasn't fun. But yeah, that's neither here nor there.
Do you have any more
things for tuning into another episode? Another episode of That's Neither Here Nor There.
Starring a follow up.
Michael Eads had written this thing on his website today about the record and it being ahead of its time. It's totally true. Like, it would be popular now. I mean, I would think. I don't know. Some weird...
We'll see, I guess.
Actually, maybe it would be...
It's coming out now.
Hopefully.
But it was true. Like, everything, the songwriting and the playing and just the ideas were not really 2005. So,
thanks.
It's a great record. What do you guys think about it now? I mean,
I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
There was a few things with the recording that I would have done differently if I could take those songs and record them again. Mostly just that I made as a guitar player. Like, one thing I did was too many overdubs. I learned a lesson on that record. I would record every single guitar part I had an idea for, and then thinking that I would weed them out later, and then I would be like, oh, there's 8 different guitar parts, and I don't know what's happening with these anymore, and it was too confusing. But yeah, and little things like that, just mostly about, you know, the recording process. Those are my only things that I would do differently now. But yeah, I'm proud of that record for sure. I think it sounds good. I think the songs are good. I think that's the first record that I ever recorded my singing on that I was proud of my singing.
I still think about it as at least 2 different records. Like, for me, between the two sides, it's kind of 2 different records. But like, it feels like maybe 3 singles packaged together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like conceptually.
Yeah, like it doesn't... I love it, and I think it's got some of our best songs on it, most of our best songs on it. I think the recording is as good as anything I've done, but like, for me, it's like splitting up between, like, the opening set of songs are so good together, and then like Situation Hot is such a great song, and then the 3 songs on the second side, I always thought about in terms of 2 sides, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, Even If You Don't Die, Custom Critical, Jobs a Game, that's a set of songs. And like Plans of Tennessee is a set of songs. Like, I kind of always, it's been hard for me to think about it in, like, separately, you know, like putting it together as a record. Feels like a compilation to me, I guess.
Yeah, no, I don't have a lot to say about it other than I'm pretty proud of it. I think it, you know, sounds good. I think the songs are good. I'm proud of them. I probably listened to it more than I probably should, being that I'm in that band. But yeah. You know, also I have a 6 CD. Changer in my car that I never change the CDs on, so it's
been in there for 10 years.
Probably a good 10 years.
We toured in that in like 2004. Like, we toured in that.
We almost died in that motherfucker in Chattanooga. Me and you, homie.
Wait, in what vehicle?
My CRV.
Driving back
up on that damn mountain.
That's right.
Come back from the failed show in Chattanooga.
From Chattanooga.
Yeah.
We
were like, oh shit.
Also, I think going back to the touring thing and why we didn't tour more. I think we had more than our fair share of like crummy fucking shows for how few we played out.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Like, I would say over a quarter of them just sucked. And I know maybe that's not that high a percentage, but like, we didn't play that many shows out. And we had, I'd say, quite a few really terrible ones. And then through no fault of our own, you know, just...
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Circumstances.
We played a decent amount of shows out, but...
It was 2006. There wasn't, like, a good way to promote a show out of town other than playing that town 5
before
times
before
that.
Before that goddamn social media.
That's
we
right.
just had that social media.
Yeah.
Man, Ryan, look. I think if we figured out one thing tonight, we should have had that social media.
And we would have invented the social media.
Yeah. Actually, go ahead and hit the space bar.
Actually, I did forget one question. Why did you remaster the record? For the record, for vinyl?
Yeah, for vinyl.
Yeah.
It needed to be mastered differently for vinyl.
I'm very happy about that.
And then we went ahead and had...
The drums are a little bit more.
Baldwin did a great job.
Well, and like mastering is a tricky thing where like the technology...
It's black magic.
It's, well, the technology keeps progressing where it's like...
You did more of less.
Yeah.
So did John Baldwin get the mixes? Like
he was given...
So we... I'm not 100% certain. What I believe... to have happened. What I believe happened is that we got in touch with Golden, and they
That's
were,
right.
And they were like, yeah, we don't hold on to original files that were delivered for mastering.
For 10 years ago.
And for 10 years ago. And we wrote back and we're like, Jeremy, I hope you don't mind, we may need you to remix this because he wasn't able to find the original, like.
And he was about it. And you know what I'm saying? He was like, yep, let's do it.
Here he was go. Like, okay, but there's some other stuff going on, and like, Baldwin was able to reach out. John was able to reach out and like
to
reach out to them
Golden yeah.
directly, and he was like, "Hey, listen.
Hey, it's me, Johnny B."
Yeah, and like, and they were like, "Okay, yeah, we have it." So like, they gave him the original mixes to master off of. So like,
that's cool.
Yeah, so he was able to start from that, and like, you know, it's every 10 years. You know, like every 10 years, there's like, if you listen to something that was mastered in like 2006, if you listen to this match in 2000, and like the
1996. People's tastes change, and what their stereos are capable of producing changes, yeah. You know. Right.
Have you guys heard the vinyl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the test presses.
I think it sounds great.
It sounds like shit on my stereo from 1997.
What we discovered is that through careful analysis, we discovered that Mike's stereo sounds
like okay,
shit.
Yeah, okay, full disclosure. You want a story? Here's the story. We put that test pressing in on Mike's record player, and we lost our mind. We're like, oh God, this is awful. This is completely flawed.
Like, first,
we felt like Mike when Mike was listening to
those eight songs.
The first side sounded great. The second side sounded real bad.
Because there was some real like bass. Some critical in that boom,
floor tom sounded like a fart in a tuba or something.
It was awful. It was awful.
And we were like, oh my God, we can't accept this.
And then I went home.
I sent them. I was like, "You guys go home, take these records home.
This sounds
listen to it at home.
Really good."
And then, you know, 2 days later, because I'm super, I care about this project a lot. I finally listened to it on my stereo, but no, it sounded fine on mine, on Jeremy's, and
on speakers and headphones. It's just. It turns out that when you buy a floor model stereo from Circuit City in 1997, maybe 20 years later, it doesn't sound as good.
Yeah. But so it sounds great, and it's awesome that like you said, we got it remastered specifically because it needs to be mastered differently for vinyl than it does for a digital release.
Yeah.
But Baldwin went ahead and did a different set of files for the new digital release as well. It sounds nice and clean, and everything sounds really good.
I don't even know if I've heard the digital release.
It sounds great.
I will let Michael take care of all the information about buying it, but go buy it.
Yeah, if you want to pick up that record up, go on to youneed.com and log yourself in and log on out. Get yourself a record.
All right, is there anything else we need to cover? Is there anything else we need to talk about? Like,
I guess we're done.
Yeah.
Okay,
is
turn
it
off.
Is that
how
we're going out?
Right?
Yeah.
Is that we're going out? All right. That's it.
Bye, guys.
That's it. Boy. Okay.
Thanks, everyone,
good
for listening.
Good job, guys. I'm going to go do some Iron Banner.
Oh, shit.
I know you weren't excited.
Situation hot and ready.
Fuck.
Why did nobody make that joke until now?